And I'm really excited about today. We have a special lecturer who some of you may know as Isaac, the person whose name I holler out several times a class period when I'm screwing up something on Zoom. But other students know him, of course. Those of you who've had him as a brilliant young scholar and historian. I am thrilled to have Dr. Mays. May is our, can you pronounce his name correctly? Giving an exceedingly important lecture today on the history of the religious right, the religious left, I should say, in the U.S. We hear all too often about the religious right, and sometimes it feels like in American public life, white evangelicals are sort of have a monopoly on, you know, bylines in all the major dailies and magazines and the like. Part of what we are doing in this entire semester is trying to craft a kind of an alternative narrative to that. And Isaac is really going to get us deeper in the weeds today in this, as we look at this tradition in the 20th century American religious and political life. Isaac is currently the assistant professor of American studies at UVA and a postdoctoral fellow here at the Project on Lived Theology in the religious studies department. He only, it's just remarkable looking at his vita, which you should all sort of take and, read and thank, your gods, whatever, for having him, having the privilege of working with him. He was a Phi Beta Kappa, a graduate from Earlham College, did a master's in theological studies at Harvard Divinity School, came here, and did his MA and PhD in American religious history. He only finished his doctorate in May of 2020. But already has, you know, a publishing record that, you know, would get him tenure and promotion in most places. His doctoral dissertation will be published hopefully sometime in, what are you thinking, fall, summer or fall of 2022, Isaac? Do you have
any? Yeah, I imagine it's next year.
Yeah.
Bring the final manuscript in October.
And in addition to this, he was a contributor to the Cambridge Companion to Quakerism. You have another book in the works, which you may mention today. This is the one for Brill Press. Am I correct?
It's American Quaker Resistance to War. It's World War I to Vietnam.
Extraordinary. And those of you who were in my civil rights seminar may remember his sort of final tour de force this gift of a lecture that covered the history of nonviolence in about an hour and a half. And I will make sure that link is posted for your edification. His specialty in American religious history is sort of religion and modernity, liberal religion, and the religious left. And as you know, he is especially interested in the study of pacifism, religion and law, and how religious groups respond to the pressures of secularization. I will look forward to Isaac's lecture presently, and am grateful to him, as I know you are as well, for the work that he has done to make this course hopefully a success, at least logistically. Smooth, and also to write the special lecture for us today. By way of kind of contextualizing Isaac's talk, I would just like to turn briefly to a section in the Beloved Community. I don't know whether you have that in front of you, but, I wanted to just say, like 5 or 6 minutes, five or 8 minutes of kind of, a historical and, if you will, theological context for Isaac's talk today that moves us from Antonioni, John Didion, into Richard Rorty and some of the problems raised here. And this is on the page 132. And if you have your book in front of you, you can simply follow along with me, middle of the page. And you will remember that in the opening scenes of Zabriskie Point, which we finished on Thursday, there's a contentious debate between black and white student activists underway on a California campus. And as the camera surveys the scene in a kind of documentary fashion, you know, we hear the students sort of speak in what now strikes us as tired kind of revolutionary cliches. The film, even with its amateur actors and tedious plot, offers insight into the causes of a movement unraveling. Furious black men in Che Guevara berets and army fatigues punctuate their violent mantras with seething street wisdom. Molotov cocktails are a mixture of gasoline and kerosene. White radicalism is a mixture of bullshit and jive. A concerned woman protests that a lot of white people are potential revolutionaries, even as a goateed Marxist complained that the coffee's run out and ask a woman to make another pot. Can't a man make a cup of coffee, she replies in disgust. Black radical Kathleen Cleaver, playing herself, threatens to close down the school, quote, because we haven't gotten what we needed. No one really knows what they need, but that's kind of part of this atmosphere. Meanwhile, Mark, the film's protagonist, appears agitated and annoyed when someone asks the radicals in the room if they're willing to die for the cause. Mark, who's been silent until now, rises to his feet and says, yeah, I'm willing to die, but not from boredom. He then leaves the room with a shrug. The debate continues briefly in his absence, that there is not much more to learn. These young activists have grown to hate or distrust each other as much as the system against which they wage inchoate struggle. So the question that kind of helps frame where we're turning today and the last week and a half is, what became of the student radicals, you know, holding forth, these student radicals holding forth on the revolution? And what more importantly, what became of those summer volunteers, the beatnik, you know, priests and beatnik activists, the young idealists who traveled south with their hopes of building the beloved community? And why did their goals become so kind of deracinated and self-referential? So in Achieving Our Country, the book that we're reading this week, which is an extraordinary book, it's short, it's compact, and it, in my opinion, is one of those compelling and helpful kind of narratives of what, you know, of where, you know, what became of these radicals and where we are now. Rorty introduces us to two varieties of the leftist thought in 20th century America, what he calls the old left and its reformist children of the civil rights movement, and the new left and its academic children, in his estimation, of the kind of postmodern academy. Rorty's book reads like, though he's an atheist, and as he once said in a lecture here at UVA, I'm an old-fashioned atheist, the kind that believes that when you die, you rot. So yeah, he's pretty clear on that identification. His book reads like a sermon preached with missionary conviction. I should tell you that Richard Rorty is also the grandson of Walter Rauschenbusch. So that's one of those little ironies of history that we could ponder. Rorty calls the contemporary left down from what he thinks of as its ethereal perch to reckon with everyday misery and social despair and to set forth clear proposals for social progress. The problem with theory is not its complexity, he explains. The problem is rather more prosaic and mundane, namely the difficulty of clambering back to earth from a high level of abstraction to a level on which one might meaningfully discuss tax laws, organizing initiatives, housing policies, our political debates. And as helpful as his critique is, and as much as I learned from it, his analysis of the left's retreat from the sort of tradition of American sort of progressive piecemeal social reform lies in his rather blithe indifference to the rich history of religious-based social reform, in other words, the religious left. And I want us to, as we move to Isaac, sort of, do the work of kind of understanding and reclaiming that tradition. It is true, if I could just add one more paragraph, that in the closing decades of the 19th century, you know, as we read in Rauschenbusch's critique of the premillennial dispensationalists and their withdrawal from political and social engagement, there were frequent complaints as well within the ranks of the labor movement about the church's lack of involvement. In 1892, for example, Terence Powderly, a member of the Knights of Labor, said, "You can count on the ends of your fingers all the clergymen who take any interest in the labor problem." But that same year, Rauschenbusch, again, Rorty's maternal grandfather, led a group of Protestant ministers, as you remember, and theologians to commit themselves to the practical realization in the world of the kingdom of God, which they understood to include the marching host of labor. And then this paragraph, a welcome for the work that Isaac has done for us today. By the 1930s, social activism in America, and especially the progressive experiments in agricultural cooperatives and labor organizing in the South, were saturated with religious conviction. As Anthony Dunbar writes in his wonderful book, recently reprinted by University Press of Virginia, Against the Grain, Southern Radicals and Prophets, 1929 to 1959, the radical Christians who made up such organizations as the Southern Tenants Farm Workers Union, the Fellowship of Southern Churchmen, the Southern Conference for Human Welfare, the Highlander Folk School, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, people like Howard and Alice Kester, Sherwood Eddy, Claude Welch, Zilphia and Miles Horton, Septima Clark, Sherwood Eddy, and on, spoke passionately of social progress and reform of land for the landless, full and decent employment, the holding in common of all natural resources and all scientific processes, and the liberation of all workers from enslavement to the machine. These, if you will, members of the religious left, cared for the poor and oppressed through a broad range of initiatives in community and union organizing and also in educational reform. And they used the power of testimonial and narrative to educate the nation about poverty, presenting heartbreaking portraits of day laborers who swelled the ranks of the dispossessed, squeezed out by the large plantations, insurance companies, and banks, of homeless families combing the nation for a decent living and a decent landlord, on the rivers and flatboats and the coves, swamps, and on the barren hillsides, a great mass of wanderers without homes, food or work, half-clothed, sick, of body and soul, unwanting and unloved in the kingdom of King Cotton. I think that was Sherwood Eddy, if I'm not mistaken, that poetic phrase, of the manipulation of racial fears by well-to-do planters who played black against white in their cynical game of material acquisition. These men and women were carried by a river of spiritual religious passion into lifetimes of social activism. And such accounts as their lives offer give us, I think, a vivid and synoptic realism about social existence precisely because these progressives, those who were coming from the Christian tradition, saw Jesus in the dispossessed and in the margins and in the excluded. So really grateful. Thank you for allowing me a few extra minutes today, Isaac, to set that up. And we look forward to your lecture.
Great. Really appreciated the warm introduction. I think it actually gets to many of the points that I'm talking about with Rorty today. So I'm really glad to be talking to you on the day that we read Achieving Our Country. Rorty is somebody that I think has a lot to admire in his thought. As a philosopher and a political thinker, I often think of myself as heavily inspired by Rortian liberalism in my own outlook. And I really appreciate his efforts to show that there are firm connections between the radical revolutionary new left of the 60s and the older pro-union reformist left, including people who worked in government, that were very close to the Democratic politics and were involved with things like the New Deal. And I really admire his point that 100 years from now, Harrington and Schlesinger, this socialist leader and this Kennedy administration advisor, and Jane Addams and Angela Davis, the reformer at Hull House and the more radical thinker, or Felix Frankfurter, the Supreme Court justice, and civil rights leader John Lewis, he says, they'll all be seen as having advanced the cause of justice. They will all be seen as part of the left. And I think that scholarship tends to maybe go against what Rorty is saying. Too often, historians and philosophers are splitters rather than lumpers. They see the divisions among people, and they point us to a left that looks very not united, that looks very opposed. And Rorty points out that there's maybe more cohesive here than it initially appears. But as Professor Marsh alluded to, I think Rorty has some real blind spots that are really surprising coming from someone that's the grandson of Walter Rasenbusch. I think that Rorty overwhelmingly ignores the religious left, which was a cohesive movement and often directly intertwined with the political aspects of the left that he talks about. I think that you can't really tell the story of the American left without talking about religion. And I think that Rorty is outright wrong in his understanding of Walt Whitman and John Dewey, his two prophets of civic religion, and even his two prophets, perhaps, of liberalism. And he tells us early on in the book that the most striking feature of their redescription of the country is its secularism. I don't think that's true at all. All of this looks pretty religious to me. The left looks very, very religious, I think, when we go into it. They're not always conventional in their religious views. They don't always look like what we would think of as American evangelicals or viewpoints that are sometimes labeled as fundamentalists. They're not as always attached to the Bible in the same ways that people who are seen as, quote, traditional are, but they're still religious at heart. And I also think that while we can look at the 1960s as a decline, Rorty is right. Something happened to the left in the 1960s. It happened to the religious left as well as the rest of the left. I'm not sure that the same things are always at stake. Rorty pitches a battle between people on the left that are communists and people on the left that aren't communists. How people position themselves in regards to the USSR is the most central, salient thing for him throughout most of the history of the 20th century. I don't think that's always the case if we look at the religious left. So I'm going to focus today on what Rorty, I think, leaves out of his account. I'm going to make that argument that you can't have a left in the U.S. without the religious left, that that's not a coherent story. And to do this, I want to focus mostly on one city. And so I'm going to share my screen. I've got a keynote presentation. If you've got questions, feel free to unmute yourself here. Unfortunately, the way keynote works, I won't be able to see you on the screen. But if you have any kind of problem, just please speak up. And Professor Marsh, if for some reason I blank out, just give me a call, okay? Okay, so I'm going to share my screen. That's going to pop up in 1 second. Let me enable my keynote. And can you see the screen? It should say Golden Age of the Religious Left. Do you see that? Someone unmute and tell me you're seeing it.
Yes. Yes, okay. We see it.
Excellent. Okay. So I'm going to focus mostly on one city, New York, between the 1920s and the 70s. This is a national movement, but I think that a focus on one place helps make the point that this was a community, a unified group of people that often knew each other, that you could look at other places, but New York, I think, makes this story very clear and it helps us have a coherent narrative about these things. Okay, so let me move on here. This is a picture by Fritz Eichenberg. Fritz Eichenberg is of Jewish descent. He's a Quaker, and he also worked for the Catholic Worker. So this is Jesus working with the masses here, right? Jesus with the dispossessed. I always think it's a great woodcut that sort of shows many of the aspirations of the religious left. So to start us off, I really think if you're tracing the history of the religious left, you'd have to go back into the 19th century. I'm not going to talk too much about this today, but one place that I would mark as the birthplace of the American religious left is in Divinity Hall and Harvard Divinity School. Professor Marsh is nodding his head probably because he recognizes this room. This is where Ralph Waldo Emerson gave the Divinity School address to a graduating class of Unitarian ministers. And so in 1838, Emerson gets up and he gives a speech proposing a new kind of religion. He says, let us do what we can to rekindling the smoldering, nay, quenched fires of the altar, right? The evils of the church are now made manifest. He goes, what do we do now that religion no longer does what it used to do? 19th century has changed how we're religious. Emerson has a new proposal. What he ends up proposing is that Emerson suggests the remedy is soul first, second soul, and evermore soul, a new kind of religion. And for many people on the American religious left, this is a manifesto. Some people take this to mean that they need a new kind of Christianity. Some people take it outside of Christianity, and Emerson's immensely influential in how people think of themselves. A full history of the religious left would also have to point out that the abolitionist movement in the 19th century is heavily tied to various kinds of religious left activism. This is the front page of the anti-slavery paper, The Liberator, the main mouthpiece when it comes to liberal religion in the United States and towards anti-slavery activism. You'll note what's in the center of this. It's a picture of Jesus liberating slaves, right? There's a Bible verse here on the side. You can see it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor. Leaders like William Lloyd Garrison, the editor of this paper, preached an anti-slavery gospel. The abolitionist movement disproportionately had a heavy involvement from different kinds of religious radicals in it. You've probably heard many times by now, I'm a Quaker, so there's a vast overrepresentation of Quakers who were anti-slavery in this period, including Quaker women. And so women like Angelina and Sarah Grimke and Lucretia Mott combine speaking out on anti-slavery topics with an advocacy for women's rights. And so in many ways, I think you can make the argument that the religious left gives rise to both an abolitionist sentiment in the U.S., but also to the women's rights movement that takes hold in the 19th century. So let's zoom in on New York. In New York, you see many of the religious left currents that appear in the rest of the country. Often they're even more visible. So in the 19th century, the abolitionist movement has one particular advocate there that's worth pointing out, and that's Henry Ward Beecher. And you probably actually kind of heard the name Beecher in some context, probably way back in high school. You heard a little bit about Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, an anti-slavery book that really helps fuel abolitionist sentiment in the United States, argues about that slavery is cruel. And in hindsight, Uncle Tom's Cabin looks pretty racist to contemporary eyes, but in the moment it is seen as a clarion call that people should rally against slavery. That's Henry Ward Beecher over here, his sister. And Beecher is a Congregationalist minister. He's the son of a Congregationalist minister, and he becomes minister of a place called Plymouth Church in New York. And he's outspoken in his own advocacy for abolition. He's an early supporter of women's rights. And he's notable because he's one of the first people in the U.S. to have a very public platform to be in favor of evolution, to argue that you can be both Christian and believe in evolution. Beecher is a little bit of a scandalous personality in the late 19th century. He has an affair. This gets outed. The trial of the century, according to most people in the 19th century, is Henry Ward Beecher has a trial all about his infidelity. And he's also notable because you'll note this is actually a soap ad. He's probably the first American featured in any kind of sponsored advertisement. So this particular ad was actually done after he died. I couldn't find the one from when he's alive, but this is the first celebrity endorsement that you can see in print in the U.S. where Henry Ward Beecher uses Pear's soap and has like a whole bunch of lines about how great Pear's soap is and how he stands by it. So he's really very much a leading cultural figure as well. If you're wondering who leads the left in the United States in the 19th century, not only the religious left, but the left, people would probably be thinking about a figure like Henry Ward Beecher as a key person that you'd point to. Now, another person involved in the 19th century in the religious left is somebody that you're actually introduced to by Richard Wordy. And this over here, number 99, is the house of a guy who lived in Brooklyn, Walt Whitman. And I think Wordy actually reads Whitman kind of wrong here. Wordy is a very bright philosopher, right? Really knows, has some great quotes here, but he reads Whitman as kind of godless. When I think Whitman was just kind of enchanted with God in a variety of different ways, I think Whitman was a pantheist. I think for Wordy, Wordy argues that Whitman sees God essentially nowhere. And in contrast, I think I want to make the argument that Whitman sees God basically everywhere. And that the reason Rorty thinks that Whitman is secular is that Whitman is so obsessed with God that Rorty misses this. It's just so ubiquitous. So Rorty quotes, actually, some of Whitman, right, from League of Grass. And Rorty quotes this bit here at the top. "And I say to mankind, be not curious about God, for I who am curious about each am not curious about God." And Rorty goes, this is a shot sign that Walt Whitman has faith in America and is secular. I think if you go down a couple of lines to the other part I put in green, you don't really see the same themes. Whitman goes on in the same bunch of lines. "I see something of God each hour of the 24. In each moment then, in the faces of men and women, I see God. In my own face in the glass, I find letters from God dropped in the street, and every one is signed in God's name." This is not, I would argue, a sort of America that is secularized without God. This is an America in which literally God is like so present that you cannot divorce yourself from the reality of God because God is everywhere. Where is the kingdom of God for Walt Whitman? Well, the kingdom of God is here right now in America. It's not a secular kingdom of God. It's not the secular realization of American promise. America, to the extent that Whitman is extolling it in his works, is a religious project. And I think we got to understand it that way. Now, to keep talking about people you just find in New York, and again, we could talk about any number of other places, but I want to keep this to one place to just give you a sense that this is rooted of people who succeed each other, are often connected to each other. Another person we could talk about here is this guy, Washington Gladden. And who is Washington Gladden? Washington Gladden is one of the early leaders in the social gospel movement. And he's a Congregationalist pastor. And he worked in a number of different roles throughout his life, but he is connected to New York because he's the religion editor of a paper called the New England Independent. And when Gladden works in that job, being a religion editor turns out to be a really important job in the late 19th century, he opposed Tammany Hall and Boss Tweed. So he is against the machine politics of New York that seek to run New York City in an undemocratic way. And he's one of the outspoken leaders of what will become the progressive movement, arguing for a more democratic system of politics. And for Gladden, this is a religious project. This is what you're supposed to do as a religion editor. This is not he's engaged in secular politics. This is part of his ministry. Later on, Gladden becomes a pastor in Springfield, Massachusetts. And Springfield is a major center of the textile industry. It's a major center of different kinds of emerging industries in the United States. And in 1876, Gladden writes a book, Working People and Their Employers, in which he advocates for unionization. And he's one of the first clergymen in the United States to support unions, to approve of unions. Now, Gladden argues that he's not a socialist, and he's not in favor of laissez-faire economics, but instead he's got another position. We might now call this social democracy. That's not what Gladden describes it as. Gladden describes this as Christian law. And he argues that if you apply Christian law to industry, to social reform, to do things like stop child labor, that that's going to humanize labor, and you'll have a system that works far better for both workers and employers. And I mean, I think it's worth noting that that Christian law is not an unintentional usage here. And I actually think Rorty maybe knows all of this and just doesn't want to talk about it. It complicates his story. And we actually see this when Rorty references another figure that's closely tied to Gladden here. Rorty talks about a guy named Richard T. Ely, who wrote against child labor, he wrote against unions, and he wrote about the barbarities that he witnessed over laissez-faire capitalism, right? Washington Gladden sees children working in mills and he is horrified. He sees people working in meat plants and goes, there need to be safety standards. I'm sorry, Richard T. Ely thinks these things. And Ely writes a famous book, and it's called Social Action and Christianity. And Rorty actually mentions this and briefly mentions that here Ely is a leading economic thinker, probably the dominant economic thinker speaking out against laissez-faire economics in the late 19th century. But he never actually mentions the fact that the social democracy that Ely is plugging for Eli is explicitly flaming as a part of Christianity, that it's part of his Christian message, that he actually founds an organization of Christian economists, and that that Christian economic organization is actually intended to change capitalism. It is a religious change happening, right? We may go intervention in the economic world. Now, that sounds pretty political, but in the 19th century, this is a form of religious activism. So now I want to anchor my talk to a bunch of specific places. And so I made a map. Google Maps actually lets you create maps. I'm going to talk about a bunch of different places, and I put them all on this map just to show you where they are. Most of the things I'm going to be talking about are in, they're pretty much all actually in Manhattan. Most of them are clustered up towards Morningside Heights, right near Harlem here. So this is a couple of blocks, right? If we're thinking about all the people I'm going to be talking about, it's hard to talk about the American religious left because it is so diverse. It spans the entire country. It spans well over 100 years of history, right? It's a thing I could talk about all day. So I'm going to try and confine my talk by going, we're just going to talk mostly about this neighborhood. I'm going to make a brief mention of over here down by the UN building. And to zoom in, we're really talking about, again, a couple of blocks, right? This is Columbia University, a little north of Columbia University. Most of the things I'm going to be talking about are over in here. You can see the labels as I get to them. So I want to start talking about the places and the people connected to them. In the 20th century, there are several institutions that exist promoting a religious liberal vision within several blocks in Manhattan. And they're promoting a vision of the American left more generally. And one of them you probably know. I would bet that you all recognize this place right here, right? It says King's College up here. That's the original name. This is Columbia University, right? You've all probably seen this in various depictions in media. If you watch the opening to Ghostbusters, right, the opening to Ghostbusters is they're coming out right here of the library of Columbia University. And if you go to New York, it's definitely worth taking a trip up here just to see it, because I think it's a beautiful campus. Columbia really does advance the left in a variety of ways in the 20th century. There are two schools in New York City. Columbia has that really do this, but Columbia has less of a quota on Jews than most other prestigious universities during this time period, which opens it up to new kinds of ideas and more kinds of thoughts. Columbia still is exclusionary towards women, right? It's still got really, like, it's definitely not open in the way we would think of a university open now to a variety of different kinds of identities, but allowing Jews when most universities are imposing strict quota system is remarkable. City College of New York, which is a public university, actually has no quotas on Jews, and so it's often referred to as the Jewish Harvard, and it's attracting all kinds of diverse and interesting ideas simply because it's not restricting who can go there. It's far more open intellectually than much of the rest of the United States. And for our story of the American left, this is also an important place because it's the home of one of the people that Richard Rorty talks to us about. It's the home of John Dewey. John Dewey comes here in 1904, and he is there until 1930. And so if we're thinking, like, where is Dewey located? Well, he's located right in the middle of Manhattan at Columbia. Let me advance my slide. Now, I think that Rorty's reading of Dewey is maybe a little better than his reading of Whitman, right? I'm not sure that Dewey is enchanted with God in quite the same way Whitman is. But I don't think that Dewey's really what you'd call secular either. Dewey writes a book that's probably his clearest expression of religion, and Dewey is not a clear writer, so clearest expression of religion may perhaps be an indication that it's still not the most clear book you've ever read. But this book that he writes is called A Common Faith, and it extols Dewey's vision of democracy and what brings people together. In it, Dewey argues for what he calls a new kind of religion, a religion that is not supernatural. But he also explicitly rejects the secular in that book. He says what he's advocating for is not secularism, but a religious faith in human community, that it's a binding kind of human community that brings people together in a religious way. Now, you may agree or disagree with Dewey that, like, whether that's religious or not, you're ditching belief in God, you're going to ditch the supernatural, you're just going to believe in the fellowship of, right, all human beings towards each other. But I do think that we at least have to note that Dewey really wants to make the claim that he is not secular here, that this is a vision that is just as religious as people going to Christian churches down the street. And that A Common Faith is written as one of Dewey's proudest works to extol this vision so that everybody can adopt it, coming from the philosopher at Columbia. Now, there are other institutions other than Columbia that I think promote a vision of the left and maybe are more directly tied to the religious left. One that we really have to talk about that's come up a lot in this class is the Union Theological Seminary. Union is founded as a Presbyterian seminary, and after a heresy trial in 1892, when the Presbyterians try a Union professor, Charles Briggs, for his historical analysis of the Bible, Union decides that they're going to break off from the denomination and become ecumenical. They'll be open to all kinds of Christians, and eventually they're even open to various kinds of non-Christian traditions in some ways as well. They host all kinds of radical professors and students. Professor Marsh is nodding along here because Dietrich Bonhoeffer famously visits Union Theological Seminary, right, spends some time in the guest room. This is actually, I believe this is a shot from the old guest room in Union. Fortunately, Union's had some hard times, so much of Union will probably eventually become condos, but it's still hanging on in New York. And Union, you probably actually remember from this class because it's where Reinhold Niebuhr is a professor. Right. So if we're thinking, where are these ideas located? Union is often an institutional citadel for the religious left in the United States, particularly the Protestant religious left. And that's true for most of its history. We could probably do an entire course that was just thinking about the religious left through the lens of Union Theological Seminary. There are different institutions in the U.S. that are really disproportionately influential. And I think like Union is often disproportionately influential when it comes to the religious left and thought. I did want to talk about some of the people from Union that maybe we don't talk about as much and talk about how they complicate our narrative from Rorty. This guy over here is Harry Ward. And Harry Ward is born in 1873 in England. He comes to the U.S., and he becomes a Methodist minister. And by 1906, Harry Ward isn't just a Methodist, he's a Marxist. He reads Karl Marx, he is convinced that Marxism is right, and he thinks that Marxism and Christianity go together a bit like peanut butter and jelly. And Ward begins to advocate for social change. And I would think that many of the social changes that Ward advocates we would find very admirable. Ward writes The Social Creed of the Methodist Church, in which he argues for an end to child labor. He argues that the workday should have a fixed number of hours, that you shouldn't be able to work an unlimited number of hours. He argues that there is widespread economic exploitation and that there need to be regulations on working conditions. The Social Creed of the Methodist Church is later adopted by the Federal Council of Churches, a body of Protestant churches that have come together, and ends up really defining what we come to see as the later stages of the social gospel movement. At Union, Reinhold Niebuhr is actually really jealous of Harry Ward. All the students who are real radicals, the students that Niebuhr perhaps most like when Niebuhr first starts teaching, end up thinking that Ward is more radical than Reinhold Niebuhr. Harry Ward's willing to go all the way. He's an outright communist. And Niebuhr's a little bit jealous of all this. Ward eventually helps form the American Civil Liberties Union. He's outspoken in his opposition, for instance, to the oppression of African Americans. Ward is outspoken in his desire to act against Nazi Germany to help Jews. But he's not entirely admirable either, and I think he sort of shows us some of the contradictions in the American religious left. Ward's interrogated by the House of Un-American Activities Committee. They accuse him of being a secret member of the Communist Party, and he probably is. Ward may have, in fact, worked for Soviet intelligence at various points, and he certainly writes apologetics for Stalinism. Ward even has a student who immigrates to the U.S. as a young man, a guy named Julius Hecker, who goes to Union Theological Seminary, becomes a Methodist minister in his own right, gets a Ph.D. at Columbia, and Hecker is born in the USSR, or rather, he's born in Soviet Russia, but he returns to the before Soviet Russia and Russia, he returns to the USSR in the 1920s, and Hecker wants to take part in what he sees as a new emerging society as a Christian to help define it. And he hosts Ward in the USSR in 1924 and in 1932. But Hecker is actually executed by Stalin in 1938, and Ward knows this, and Ward turns a blind eye to the purges going on in the Soviet Union, and he tries his best to justify what Stalin is doing. So I think that Ward's an interesting figure here, right? Ward is part of the religious left. He maybe is that sort of communist edge that Rorty is talking about, yet he's not really completely defined by it. People engage with Ward from all over the political spectrum. Methodists are united with Ward in his project to help unionize labor, to improve the working conditions of people in factories, to end child labor. So Ward, he has these things that we'd find pretty abhorrent, turning a blind eye to Stalinism. Yet here he is also standing up for things that we could widely agree seem, I would think, in the present, morally right. Union also hosts people later as well. So I thought I would point out here Beverly Harrison. She's a Presbyterian who graduated Union Seminary with a Master's of Religious Education in 1954. She later on goes and gets a doctorate. And she returned as a faculty member to Union to teach in 1966. And she shows maybe the breadth of the American religious left. Beverly Harrison writes one of the first major works that's looking at the Christian ethics of abortion called All Right to Choose in 1983. She's the first woman who's becomes president of the Society of Christian Ethicists. And she's really influential in feminist thought in LGBTQ scholarship. And so if we're thinking about Union Theological Seminary, there are more ideas going on here than just support for the social gospel. And there's more going on in the religious left than just the social gospel. There are also some people who are still at Union. I thought I would point out here, this is Cornel West, who recently left Harvard University and headed back to Union. He probably doesn't need a lot of introduction for, I would think, most of the people here. He wrote a really important book called Race Matters. He was here in Charlottesville on August 12, 2017, in which he came out and gave, I thought, a really meaningful sermon against white supremacy as opposing the neo-Nazi march here. And I thought I would choose an image from him in The Matrix Reloaded, right? For some reason, he was asked by the Wachowskis when the Matrix sequel came out if he would appear. And so he appears as Councilman West, who appears for like one scene in The Matrix Reloaded. Really perhaps strange place for a Christian ethicist and philosopher to appear. But I think, you know, definitely part of an effort by him to reach a wider audience than you normally see professors reach. And he also made a rap album in an effort to reach, I think, new kinds of constituencies with his ideas. But this isn't just a story about Protestants at Union Theological Seminary. There are more people involved here. So I thought I would point out this building here. It's actually not that far from Union. This is Jewish Theological Seminary. And it is the leading seminary of conservative Judaism, which conservative Judaism tried to retain more tradition than the American Reform Movement, but it also tried to be more open to modern changes than Orthodox Judaism. And so interestingly, despite the name, the fact that it's conservative Judaism, I would still say that conservative Judaism is pretty clearly part of the American religious left. And so it really aspired from its very beginnings to train rabbis who could keep to Jewish tradition, right, have some sense of Jewish law, but also be open to the modern world. And sometimes these changes, I think, are really overt. So, for instance, conservative Judaism eventually embraces the idea that on the Sabbath, people could drive to get to synagogue if they had to, right? You could operate a car to do that. But sometimes it was also about political action. I want to point out this guy here, who is a rather interesting part of the religious left. This is Mordecai Kaplan. He actually consumes a large portion of my dissertation. He wrote a book called Judaism as Civilization. And in the early 20th century, American Jews are really trying to figure out like where they fit in American society. There are real questions. What is Judaism? Is it a race? Is it a religion? Is it a, who knows? Is it a like cultural group? And it's unclear exactly where Judaism fits in, right? Many people in the 19th century argue that Jews are some kind of distinctive race different from Anglo-Saxons, right? There are real questions about what this means for the legal rights of Jews in various places. It's worth pointing out that the U.S., although it is much less restrictive than Europe, does restrict Jewish rights until very late. For instance, Vermont restricts Jewish franchise into 1877. And so Kaplan's trying to figure out what does it mean to be Jewish in the modern world? And he argues that Judaism isn't just a religion. It's not just a group you join. He argues that it's a civilization that exists alongside Western civilization. And we might see this as at least very tied to modern notions that people can be culturally Jewish, that what makes people Jewish is taking part in Jewish traditions and ceremonies and celebrations. And so Kaplan posits an idea that unites different kinds of Judaism, that Judaism is different things, and founds what he calls Reconstructionist Judaism, which is originally a movement in conservative Judaism. And so here's the seal of Reconstructionist Judaism, the movement. He argues that support for the creation of a Jewish homeland, right, Palestine here, what will later become Israel, is important to defining Jewish identity. He argues that there's a religious component to being Jewish, that it's about culture, it's about people eating gefilte fish. It's about people engaging in Jewish tradition, right? People having a Jewish theater. It's about ethics, right? There's a way to behave as a Jew, that this is all united by taking part in a community of people, and that the United States can include all of these different notions of Jewish identity. And this gets picked up by the Reform Movement, which begins to accept that, yes, you can be Jewish in more than just a religious sense, that Judaism is more than just descent from people who are Jews. It's definitely not a racial identification. It's not just religious either. And this is a different way of being on the religious left, and I think it's a really interesting one. It doesn't really map to anything I think Rorty is talking about at all. Another person we'd probably want to talk about at Jewish Theological Seminary is this guy here, Abraham Joshua Heschel, probably most famous in the modern world for marching with Martin Luther King. He comes over from Poland in 1940, fleeing the Holocaust. And I think it's arguable, but Heschel is probably the most important American Jewish theologian in the course of the 20th century. Heschel writes about mysticism, the ways in which you can bring traditional Jewish practice into the modern world, writes a book about what the meaning of the Sabbath should be, that is incredibly influential even beyond the borders of Judaism. So many Christians end up reading his book Sabbath and being really inspired by it in a variety of different ways. To move on from JTS, I think it's also worth pointing out this building here. I don't think it's the most pretty building in the history of the world. This is what's called the Interchurch Center, but most people, after it was built, knew it by the name of the God Box. And the God Box is a 19-story office building that was it's the headquarters of the National Council of Churches. And the National Council of Churches united most of the American mainline, most Protestant groups that we would think of having real cultural influence, and many other churches in the United States. And this building was busy enough that New York City actually issued its own zip code. So its zip code is 10115, separate for this building than the rest of New York. Before this building was built, the Federal Council of Churches, the predecessor to the National Council, had headquarters in New York from 1923 onward. And this building and the predecessor were often referred to as the Protestant Vatican. They held the denominational offices of a whole variety of different American denominations. They held nonprofits that were dedicated to religious activism. There were a group of people who were basically bureaucrats that operated this a lot like a government agency. And you've got to keep in mind that here you have people from the United Methodist Church and the Baptist Church and the Congregationalist Church. They're all going to lunch together. They're all planning what the future of American Protestantism is in this moment. This is the logo. The National Council of Churches still exists, and they still speak out on key issues. So I think back to August 12th, 2017, we had representatives of the National Council of Churches when there was that neo-Nazi rally here. And of course, there are major religious sites that appear in New York, too, that make us think of the religious left. This is Riverside Church. It's a Baptist and a Congregational church funded by John D. Rockefeller and the Rockefeller family. And it was designed to be perhaps the most prominent pulpit in the United States. Martin Luther King gives the 1967 Beyond Vietnam speech from the pulpit here. Right. If you're thinking, where do you go to get a nationwide audience? Riverside Church is a good place to do it if you're thinking about the religious left. And probably the most famous liberal Protestant minister in the U.S. before the Second World War was the minister there. This is Harry Emerson Fosdick on the cover of Time magazine. So, you know, he's a big deal. And Fosdick was trained at Union Theological Seminary, and you may have actually run into him in a history class before. In 1921, he delivers one of the most famous sermons in American history, Shall the Fundamentalists Win?, in which he argues that you could have a different kind of Christianity that isn't yoked to fundamentalism or biblical literalism. Fosdick is a huge supporter of theistic evolution. Fosdick, after World War I, and he's ends up regretting his support of World War I, becomes a major advocate for an international organization that will help bring about peace, and becomes a pacifist. Fosdick's also responsible for a real change in American religious life. He introduces the idea that a church is more than just a place in which you worship. A church is a community center. So his church tries to do various things like offer classes so that people can come in to just stop by and have groups on parenting, for instance. Probably the biggest thing he introduces is the idea of pastoral counseling. So he thinks that you should introduce psychology alongside ministry, and so that ministers won't just be guys who advise you on religious life. Fosdick thinks, one, they should be more than just guys. He does back women's ordination, but they should also be people trained in various kinds of therapeutic methods. And this gives rise to what is eventually called clinical pastoral education. It is a mandatory part of ministerial education for almost all clergy these days. At least in the Protestant mainline and most Jewish groups, and increasingly in Islamic groups and Buddhist ones as well. Have some experience with this, having done some chaplaincy at UVA Hospital, and this is designed to be a way in which a variety of different faiths can offer counseling that helps people. Fosdick is also responsible for advancing the cause of Alcoholics Anonymous. It takes off because he endorses it in the U.S., and he suggests that this is a way that people can help recover from alcoholism or addiction. Religion for Fosdick, it's not just about what happens like when you die. It's not just about your personal belief in Jesus. It's supposed to design to like serve the community, and often in ways that are even broader than what the social gospel had conceived of in its early stages. This here is someone tied to both Riverside Church and Union Theological Seminary, Sophia Fawes. And Sophia Fawes was principal of what was called the Union School of Religion. And she's a major pioneer when it comes to religious education. She writes what's called the New Beacon series. They have a series for children called Martin and Judy that's designed to help children explore new ideas of God, to explore their faith by looking at the natural world. She ended up writing about 40 different books. I would argue she's the most influential religious educator in 20th century America. And Fawes was not always necessarily well-liked. You've actually probably read some sort of, we might call it subtweeting, of her in a book that you've read for this class. Reinhold Niebuhr sort of obliquely references Fawes in a very nasty way in Leaves from a Tame Cynic, in which he suggests that her approach, which suggests that children should come to God on their own, is godless, and he doesn't like it very much. But not everyone thought the same things as Reinhold Niebuhr. Her ideas were widely embraced in many different denominations. And if you went to Sunday school in a mainline Protestant church or a group like the Unitarian Universalists, my guess is that many of the ideas you were taught with owe a lot to Sophia Fawes. King, as I've mentioned, gives the Beyond Vietnam speech. It's one of King's most important speeches in 1967, sitting at the pulpit of Riverside Church. King uses that pulpit in order to tie the civil rights movement to opposition to the war. And I think it's a really sort of courageous thing to do. Not everyone thinks that he should. Bayard Rustin, who's helped organize the 1963 March on Washington, thinks this might be the demise of the American civil rights movement. You're betraying the Democratic Party by doing it. But King feels that he has to. And so I thought I would just play a really brief clip from this.
In Chicago, I cannot be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. My third reason moves to an even deeper level of awareness, for it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last three summers, as I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men. I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problem, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
So that's King, and I think it's just useful to note here that it's not an accident this is at Riverside Church. Rather, it is part of King seeing himself as in conversation with a broader American religious left, right? He knows the legacy of Riverside Church. He knows the legacy of Fosdick, and he's definitely, I think, playing on that in choosing that as the location. And King's speech there is because he's part of an organization called Clergy and Laity Against Vietnam, right? He's taking part with other clergy members to oppose the war. This here is another location. This is Abyssinian Baptist Church. It's a Black Baptist megachurch, if we were to use maybe a contemporary term for it. And as Professor Marsh has noted in his own work, Dietrich Bonhoeffer has a connection here too. During his visit to the United States, he attended here and really got some sense that Christianity needed to be intertwined with the pursuit of earthly justice. In the period that Bonhoeffer was here, the minister here was Adam Clayton Powell Sr., who taught a vision of the social gospel. But I actually want to talk a little bit about his son, maybe another interesting figure in the American religious left who shows a different side of it. This is Adam Clayton Powell Jr. And he's born in 1908. And I think few figures better show us the promise and maybe the limitations of the American religious left, as well as how intertwined it is with the rest of the left. Adam Clayton Powell Jr. here is educated at Colgate University, where he actually passes for white until students discover he's black. As the son of a minister, he's seen as something of a playboy, and no one thinks he's going to go into the ministry because he really prefers to just hang out with his friends and attend nightclubs. But in 1930, he says he has this religious experience and feels called to take up the pulpit. And so he's originally educated at Union Theological Seminary, but he drops out and gets an MA in religious education at Columbia. In the pulpit, he really has what we would refer to as liberal or radical theological views. He derides supernatural religion. At one point, he gets up and gives a sermon and says, "We do not believe the Bible is the word of God. It is too filled with contradictions. We believe in the Thomas Jefferson Bible. That is the Bible from which I speak," referring to the fact that Jefferson cut up the Christian Bible to take out all the miracles. Adam Clayton Powell is like, "That's great. That's the kind of like Christianity that I want." And he gets very involved in politics. He helps organize activism in Harlem around city busing. He's right in the segregation going on in city busing in Harlem. He's elected to city council, and he's ultimately elected to the U.S. Congress. And he constantly courts controversy. He's got a very controversial personal life. He's married three times. He's investigated for tax fraud. He is probably involved with the mob in the sense that he's connected to what's called the numbers racket, an illegal lottery going on in Harlem. But he is also very active in furthering the cause of civil rights. Powell introduces what are called Powell Amendments to various bills that come up in Congress. And what these are basically what we would call riders. They are parts that add on to existing congressional legislation. And the Powell Amendments seek to block federal funds to any state or school that isn't segregating. And the idea is that this will torpedo many pieces of legislation. So either Southern senators have to pass Powell Amendments, right, and pass them, or they end up not passing that legislation at all. You basically block all legislation unless people are willing to end segregation. And Powell Amendments actually become what is part of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So it's a really unique way to sort of force states to desegregate, to get around states' rights arguments that states have the ability to stay segregated. Powell is a huge supporter of the minimum wage and Medicare. But again, we always need to temper, I think, maybe our admiration of Powell with the knowledge that he's a figure that could be divisive. And probably the most controversial thing about him now is that he tried to blackmail Martin Luther King to call off protests against the Democratic National Convention by falsely accusing King of having a gay affair with Bayard Rustin, the organizer of the 1963 March on Washington. Right, so Powell definitely courted some controversy. Here's a brief clip of Powell.
I know here you're in trouble, where it says about 30% are unemployed. That's why I'm working hard to get this surplus food here. Some of you say to me, well, I'm not like you. I'm not a congressman. I haven't got education. I haven't got work. But you're a human being. And you know what you've got? You've got in your hand the power to use your vote and to use even those few cents you get from welfare to spend them only where you want to spend them. A young slave boy stood one day before the greatest ruler of his day. And God said to Moses, what's in your hand? And Moses said, Lord, only I've got a stick, that's all. He said, well, let me use what's in your hand. And God used that slave boy with a stick in his hand to divide the Red Seas, march through a wilderness, bring water out of rocks, manna from heaven, and bring his people to freedom land. What's in your hand?
I think it's worth pointing out that Adam Clayton Powell here, he is a minister and he is a congressman, right? He is holding both those roles simultaneously. What's the religious left? Well, it's that. And we might think about a figure that is far, far less perhaps morally mixed than Adam Clayton Powell. But in the contemporary moment, we've got Raphael Warnock, who's pastor of this same church that Martin Luther King is coming out of, here combining the roles of being in the Senate and holding a ministry position. And Warnock says that he's going to continue in ministry while being a U.S. senator. Powell, I think, continues to be a really interesting figure. He helps spread a message of black empowerment and even flirts with black power later on in his career. Early on, he's perhaps more restrained than Martin Luther King in terms of civil rights, but afterwards he argues he's more radical because he's more willing to engage with black power. I think Adam Clayton Powell really causes us to think, what does it mean for somebody to be on the religious left? What does it mean for someone to be on the political left? Are these two things separatable at all? And I also think the King-Powell divide here isn't one that maps onto a new left versus old left that Rorty's talking about. They're both religious, but they're religious in different ways. They both have very different ways of interacting with the world, but it really has nothing to do with this sort of divisions of the left that I think Rorty is referring us to. And this is an album that Adam Clayton Powell did, just his effort to reach a new kind of group, right? So you can listen to him give a combination of sermons and what's essentially like a spoken word album, Keep the Faith, Baby. Religious left shapes international politics as well. We could think about the UN here. The UN is founded in part because of the efforts of John Foster Dulles, who's a lay leader in the National Council of Churches. He helps organize the UN at the San Francisco Conference after World War II. And he's later Secretary of State, and he's an internationalist Republican. So, like, what could we include in the religious left? Well, if we see the UN as maybe a project on the left, right, a global sort of government that would have the ability to challenge the power of nation states and make a more just world, we have to maybe have a broader conception of what is it to be religious, right? Here's a prominent religious leader involved in this, as well as like who's on the left. And UN leaders, I think, also are religious in different ways. Dag Hammarskjöld, for instance, wants religion to be included as something the UN is concerned with. Professor Hedstrom over in the Religious Studies Department, currently writing a book on religion in the UN. One of the things I know he's going to look at is this here. It's the UN Meditation Room. And it's designed to be a space where all the different delegates from around the world can come, sit here, look at the abstract art, which is not a representation of anyone's specific kind of God, but be together in a worship space. And I think it's a really interesting idea that when they built the UN building, they thought this was important. The UN is also a site of some real protests by the religious left. This is Roger Laporte. He's a member of the Catholic Workers Movement, founded by Dorothy Day, really combining an advocacy for the most oppressed in society, the poor and marginalized, with pacifism. And in the 1960s, after a group of Buddhist monks set themselves on fire to protest the actions of the South Vietnamese government, there are various Americans that do the same. So there's a woman named Alice Hertz who lights herself ablaze in Detroit and dies. A Quaker named Mormon Morrison goes to the Pentagon and sets himself on fire in protest of the Vietnam War. And 10 days later, Roger Laporte, who's a member of that Catholic worker movement, goes to the steps of the UN and he sets himself on fire. And for him, he doesn't see this as suicide, right? Suicide's not allowed in Catholicism. This is the most grievous demonstration of the suffering of the Vietnamese people that he can imagine. It's a Christ-like form of martyrdom. I think activism in New York sometimes takes forms that we don't know about. This is a little short video. I'll just play a clip of a group called the Clergy Consultational Service, and this is put out by Planned Parenthood.
In 1967, something was created called the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion. 21 ministers, 19 ministers and two rabbis in New York said that they would start a service for women. And they published it on the front page of the New York Times. And they professed to do this even though abortion was a crime. But they had found some doctors who would do the abortions. They didn't have to tell me why they wanted an abortion. They only had to tell me that no one was making them do it. If they could tell me that, then I would give them the number of the doctors. There were a couple of doctors by then who would do the abortions, and they would meet. We knew we were vulnerable if the if a district attorney wanted to charge us or get after us. They could have sent a policewoman in, you know, and taped us and everything. But they didn't want to intrude. It was a little dicey to intrude on a meeting between a minister and a woman seeking advice. You know, that was a real intrusion. So there were 1,400 ministers and rabbis across the country doing this work. And only one of them was ever arrested, and he never went to trial. It was a great movement. It referred...
So we know that probably about an eighth of the illegal abortions provided in the U.S. prior to Roe versus Wade probably went through the Clergy Consultation Service in some fashion, right? So when we're thinking about the movement towards abortion, it's heavily connected to mainline Protestants and liberal Jewish groups that see this as very important. This is not a small movement going on. And here in New York City, there's an entire infrastructure that existed for this happening right in the middle of Manhattan. Activism sort of continues after the 60s. I thought I'd include this. This is a Metropolitan Community Church in New York City. Metropolitan Community Church is founded to advocate tolerance towards LGBTQ Christians. It's founded in the 60s, but the New York branch opens in 83 here. I think it's a really interesting reminder that religion is not clearly separatable from politics here. Metropolitan Community Church preached a pretty conventional Christian message, but the kinds of people they were preaching it to, people who are gay and lesbian, right, people who are part of the LGBTQ community, caused them to be very separate from other kinds of Christian groups until the 1990s and 2000s. So they were denied membership in the National Council of Churches, despite theologically looking much like other kinds of Christians in the United States until relatively recently. So is Rudy just wrong here? Does he not understand the American left? I'm not really sure that we can say that religion is ever totally separatable from the left. I think Rorty really does miss something. He's got a lot useful for us in thinking about the unity of the left, but he misses a major part of it. He's right that there a big change happens. So this is the percentage of the population adhering to faiths over time. You can tell it goes down after 1970 for groups like the Protestant mainline. Catholics hold pretty steady, but that's partially a factor of immigration. Evangelicals briefly peak. And then they seem to be going down. Something did happen in the 60s, and it did affect religion. And I don't think Rorty is wrong that something occurred. But I do think that he's not right that it's just the Vietnam War, that it is just an issue of different positions in the American left. The trends that we see in American religion actually do somewhat reflect European trends, even if there's a profound delay. I think they also reflect changes that happened in the 19th century, historical criticism of the Bible, how you look at the Bible, evolution, industrialization, debates about the role of women in LGBTQ people. And so there's, I think, Rorty maybe oversimplifies things. And I think Rorty, he's just missing something, right, by separating the religion from the left. We know, for instance, that the Socialist Party of America was a really prominent force on the far left of the U.S., But we also know that between 5 and 25% of all mainline clergy members voted for the Socialist Party during its heyday in the 1920s and 1930s, right? Who makes up the Socialist Party, the left that Rorty really wants to look at? Well, its leaders disproportionately are clergy members. And I don't think you really get that from Rorty's work. Now, no doubt, Rorty's not totally wrong on the Vietnam thing. The National Council of Churches is profoundly influential in democratic politics. Until Vietnam, Lyndon Johnson freezes the National Council and Protestants out of government over their opposition to the Vietnam War. Richard Nixon continues that policy. There's something going on with Vietnam, but I don't think we can say that Rorty has given us one explanation for how the left works. And I think overall, he's not entirely right about like what the goal of the left is for many people. For a lot of the people that we see, they're not really interested in the U.S. in terms of the U.S. as a nation. The U.S. seems maybe ancillary to many of the concerns I think we see on the religious left. They want maybe a redeemed Judaism or Christianity, but they don't really see the U.S. as critical in the way that Rorty does. And so I think where does that leave us? Well, I think there are maybe a couple of take-home points today. Religion should always complicate the narratives we tell, that if you're trying to tell the story of politics, you got to gesture towards religion in some way. And Rorty wants to not have it in there and even goes as far as to try to remove it, to scrub it out. And I don't think that's very effective. I think Rorty ends with this section with a line. Those of us who are nostalgic for the 60s should stop reminding ourselves that Schlesinger lied about the Bay of Pigs and that Hooke voted for Nixon. All of us should take pride in a country where historians will someday honor the accomplishments of both those lefts. I'm not sure that's true. I don't think historians actually honor people that often. They often critique people, so they're more likely to critique both those lefts. But whatever we do, whether it is honor or critique, I really do think this project needs to include the religious left. And Martin Luther King often quotes Theodore Parker, an American abolitionist in the 19th century. So to leave you with a quote, King said, "The arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice." And for both Parker and King, part of the American left, I think it's worth pointing out that that's not a reference to the U.S. So Obama loved this quote too and had it emblazoned on the Oval Office rug. But that arc for none of those people actually started with the creation of the U.S. And it doesn't end whenever the U.S. stops. That's literally about the entire universe. It's about God and the kingdom of God. And I'm not sure you can tell the story of the left by thinking it is just a movement rooted in the nation. So that's all I got. I'm happy to stick around if you have questions. It's the end of the class, but thank you so much for giving me your time.